So the afternoon is a little harder to lecture and a little harder to listen because everyone's had a good lunch and a bit of a play outside. So everyone has a little energy and a little sleepiness at the same time. So one has to make a special effort in the afternoon. I was just thinking when we were having our kirtan, how now if we were in Sri Vrindavan Dham, if we were so fortunate, this would be the time of the day that Krishna has a bit of a good play also. Because this is the time when he's just about to come home with the cows. And just before coming home with the cows, he has a very humorous pastime where he goes to a place called Suryakund. Has anyone here been to Suryakund? Yes, some people have been there. So at Suryakund is the place where the sun god Surya Narayan is worshipped. And Jyotila Devi, who, is, even though this is hard for us to understand, but Srimati Radharani has a mother-in-law. And Jyotila Devi is her very humorous, very suspicious, very careful mother-in-law who's always watching out in case that black snake from Nandagram, the son of Nanda Maharaj, who's very, very attractive to her daughter-in-law, should somehow or other cross the path of this innocent, beautiful, young daughter-in-law. So Krishna comes at this time, Srimati Radharani and all her girlfriends playfully come out into the forest of Vrindavan and they collect all the paraphernalia for their worship of the sun god. Because Jyotila Devi was told that every day Srimati Radharani should worship Surya Dev for the benefit of her husband. So although this is a mystical pastime, and Srimati Radharani of course has no husband, this is all Krishna's play. This is his pleasure and his, the way that he entertains himself. So he disguises himself as a very, very serious Brahmin boy from Mathura. And Jyotila is looking for a Purohit to do the puja. And then Kundalata, who's Krishna's cousin's sister, she comes along with this very nice, chaste Brahmin boy and says, this is a very nice boy, he's from Mathura, he knows how to do all the mantras and everything, and so he will do all the worship for Srimati Radharani. And Jyotila looks at him a little suspicious, but doesn't see any reason to worry. And he's very strict, actually. She says, if you'll do this worship, I will give you something. And he says, no. I'm from Mathura. That means I'm from a high caste Brahmin family from the city. Mathura is a big place. This is just a village. I won't accept anything from you. Thank you. No, I can't accept anything from you because, you know, I'm a little higher class. And so then she feels so trusting, this person who won't take anything. He's so trustworthy. And she tries to think of some way. She said, I'll give you some sweets. And who should be accompanying Krishna but Madhu Mangal, who's his very playful Brahmin friend. And so when she sees him, she says, what's he doing here? He's a friend of Krishna's. And then he says, no, I'm a Brahmin. So I come as a Brahmin. So when she says, I'll give some sweets to you, to Krishna, and he says, no, I can't take from you. And Madhu Mangal says, I'll take them. And he takes them all and he wraps them up in his chadar. He ties them all up very nicely and tucks them in, and he's very pleased because he's a voracious eater. So he has all the sweets, and Krishna performs all the mantras. But all the mantras, he says, they're very sweet. They're a little unusual. They have a hidden meaning. That is that Krishna is telling Srimati Radharani, you should worship me. And she knows the meaning, and he knows the meaning, and Jyotila doesn't understand them. She says, where did you get these mantras from? He says, oh, these are from the Vedas. You know, you're a village woman, you can't understand the Vedas. So these are all Vedic mantras. And she says, oh, okay. And then at the very end, she says to her daughter-in-law, she says, Madhu Mangal says, he knows astrology. And then she says, oh, do you think you could read my daughter-in-law's hands? Put your hands out, dear. So she puts her hands out like this. And when Krishna, disguised as a brahmana, sees the beautiful hands of Srimati Radharani, his whole body starts to tremble. And Jyotila Devi says, what's wrong? What's wrong with you? And he goes, oh, sorry. And he looks at her hands and he says, oh. He said, oh, yes. She has a very auspicious future. Oh dear. But there's a little problem with her husband. It looks like her husband is going to die very soon. And Jyotila becomes very worried and says, oh, what is this? What is this? And he says, no, it looks like... But actually, he seems to be protected by his wife, her virtuous qualities. So it's very important that every day she does this puja, comes every day at this time, and I will come also. And Jyotila is just overwhelmed with gratitude. And she thanks him up and down and says, you've done such a wonderful service to our family. I can't even think how to repay you. And she says to Srimati Radharani, take all your jewelry off. So she takes off all her beautiful gold rings and she says, now you please take this. And he, no, I don't want anything from you. She says, will you come by sometime? Come to our house. You can come to our house. And Srimati Radharani is... covered her head and she's trying not to laugh and all the girls are trying not to laugh and Jyotila's giving Radharani's rings and Madhumanga says, I'll take those. So he tucks them in his other side and he's very happy and Krishna's standing there like this and then Jyotila says, okay, now it's time to go now, and so they're leaving down the pathway and some of her girlfriends who are very clever, because this is the nature of love means you want to please another person. And this is what's lacking in this world. Everyone in this world has a desire to please themselves. And all the advertising, all the policies, all the education, every single method of teaching anything is projecting this. Take care of yourself. Have a good time. You must become something. You must do it. You can do it. Anything, but it's me. But the gopi friends of Radharani and Krishna, they have nothing like that in their hearts. They only love Radha and Krishna, and they want to see them together, despite all of these mysterious obstacles that can be in the way. So some of the gopis, they linger behind and go slowly, so that Srimati Radharani can turn around and say, hurry up! And of course, when she turns around, she can see Krishna is standing there. So they're so expert. They know just how to arrange for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna. So we have to hear about them. We have to hear about the spiritual world. And this is actually what we're going to hear about now. We're going to hear not so much about Krishna directly and his pastimes, but this is about Narada Muni again and his meeting with Vyasadeva, which is very consequential. Because Narada is the guru. As we heard, he's the guru of everyone who is a devotee. Because he is the acharya of bhakti among all the saints and sages. But he's particularly the guru of Vyasadeva. Now Vyasadeva, one morning he woke up very early in the morning. He took his bath, he did all of his sadhanas in the morning. He sat down, he began to concentrate. And Vyasadeva, he's an empowered incarnation of the Supreme Lord. So he's not an ordinary wise person. He's not an ordinary person. He's actually a transcendental personality. But he began to concentrate. And as he was concentrating and focusing his mind in meditation, he could see all of the things that were going to happen to the people who were going to take birth in Kali Yuga. He could see that these things would happen by the unseen forces in the course of time. They must happen. Just like it must be that if it's 12 o'clock in the afternoon, it must be coming 2 o'clock, then 4 o'clock, then 6 o'clock, then 8 o'clock. We know these cycles. We know they must be there, morning, afternoon, night. So in the greater cosmic arrangement of the whole creation, there are similarly cycles, and he could see. And he could see what was coming. And he knew it was going to be very, very desperate, actually, for souls like ourselves who are going to wake up here in the material world and have not a clue in the world about where we came from, who we are, or what is the real purpose of why we're here. So thinking like this, he thought the problem that will come in Kali Yuga, and think if this is not our problem, he said, is there will be too much interested in matter. Too much interested in matter, which is temporary. So great persons, they have very subtle intelligence and they can get to the essence of what a problem is. Just like an expert doctor, they can take your pulse and they can sit for a moment and think, and then they can tell you exactly what's wrong with you, because they're so refined, so expert and so subtle. So Vyas could put it like this in a simple sentence: too much interested in matter which is temporary. So they will therefore be unable to evaluate the assets of life, and they will be unable to therefore become enlightened with spiritual knowledge. And look around you. Everyone here, most everyone except for the younger children, and they go to school, most of them. And all the others go to school or they work. And when you go to work or to school, you'll meet with so many people who have no interest whatsoever in anything spiritual. In fact, they would think that you're a little strange. But then they say, okay, we're an Indian, we can understand you have your own religion. But what about a Westerner? Why do you dress like this? Why do you do these things? This is a little bit strange. They have no interest or inclination to enter into these subjects. This is a symptom of Kali Yuga. So as he knew that everything was going to deteriorate, and in previous times now gone by, everybody would hear something. If I was to read you a whole storybook, you would hear it once and remember it for the rest of your life. You would never ever have to even be reminded. You would say, okay, Teju, tell me that story. And the whole story would come out just like that. That's how intelligent people were. And now what do they have? They have little computers, right? Little computers, big day timers, this thing, that thing, all these machines to keep always remembering. They have to use all this different technology or systematize everything so they can remember. But previously they were much, much more powerful in their memory. So Vyas decided that he would write down everything, because this helps. And so he worked very, very hard. And he divided the Vedas, which are a very vast body of knowledge, into four sections. And then he wrote them, he compiled them very carefully, and then he found people who were very qualified and he taught them, so that he had an acharya of each of these Vedas. Then he had them take many students, and their students would take students, and so therefore they would create disciplic lines of how to actually disseminate all the Vedic knowledge. But then he started thinking, and he thought that then this is for very intelligent people. But what about those who are not so intelligent? Those who are like laborers, or, you know, just ordinary people? Or what about the ladies who don't have that kind of penetrating intellect usually? They're simpler. What can I do to give them something to benefit them and help them through this time that is about to come? And so he thought, and he wrote the Mahabharata. And in the Mahabharata, as one time Srila Prabhupada, I remember it was in 1976, my husband and I were in Fiji and we met with Srila Prabhupada. And he was trying to explain to me, because I'm not Indian and I had been brought up in a completely different way, what were the duties and the nature of the responsibility of being a wife, according to Krishna conscious or Vedic standards. So he was explaining to me, a wife should be like this, a wife should be like that, a wife should be like this. And the more he said, the more I was starting to feel quite nervous. And I remember finally I said to him, but Prabhupada, I wasn't brought up in this culture. And he said to me in exchange, in a very reasonable way, he said, I know that your ways are different, but if something is good, why not try for it? And later, to make his point more, he talked about Ram and Sita. And he told how Sita was such a chaste wife that Ram was prepared to kill a whole dynasty for her. That he could have made another Sita. He could have had hundreds of Sitas. But for one Sita, he taught Ravana such a lesson that his whole family and dynasty was destroyed just because of Sita's chastity. So then he said to me, these things, and he referred to the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, these two books. He said, these books have to be learned for the duty. Everything perfect. He said, wife's duty is there, son's duty is there, husband's duty is there, father's duty is there. All the duties are set out in the Mahabharata and also in the Ramayana. How to live in this life in an exemplary way. So Vyasadeva compiled this Mahabharata in this way, and then he had done all of this. He had been working so hard, it was this great transcendental science. And we would think that he would start to feel that this is actually, now I've done quite a lot of, I would feel like I've really got things moving. But instead he was feeling not at all satisfied. And then because he himself was such an exalted soul, he himself first reflected inwardly on what was the problem. Why don't I feel happy? I've done all these things for the benefit of the world, but I don't feel any joy. So he began to think. He tried to look for what it was that wasn't satisfying to his heart. It is said that perfection is never attained unless one is satisfied at heart. But this satisfaction of heart is found beyond matter. It's beyond matter. In matter, you can't be fully satisfied because the atmosphere is different. You're different, the atmosphere is different. There's an incompatibility. So he thought and he thought and he said, I know the essence of religion. I've undergone so many vows, which is very nice. I have worshipped the Vedas, which is very important. I have abided by all the rules. I followed everything very strictly. And I have shown very much importance to the idea of disciplic succession through the Mahabharata and so forth. So I've done all of these things. And yet I still feel some incompleteness. Then he started to think. And he started to think that actually what I have done that I didn't do was I did not specifically define, isolate and glorify the process of bhakti. I explained for different classes of people, different levels of religious thought, how someone at this level can advance, this one can do this, that one can do this, and so on and so forth. But I didn't actually firmly focus on the highest level of devotional service. So whilst he was understanding this, that he had not focused and explained bhakti specifically and in a large enough way, in a clear enough way, his guru Narada arrived, and when Narada arrived, he looked at Vyas, and just looking at his face, he could understand. First, he could understand his mind, he could understand the difficulties that he was facing in his thoughts, he could understand everything. So he smiled, and he said to Vyas, he said, are you satisfied having identified your mind and your body as the process of self-realization, as the objects of self-realization? And Vyas, he said, and then Narada told him, you've worked very hard. But Vyas said, yes, but I'm not very satisfied. Please tell me why I'm not satisfied, because you can understand the essence of my problem. So Narada said, you did not tell enough about Krishna. You did not share his pastimes sufficiently. You talked about dharma, how you should act in this world and you should do right and not do wrong. You talked about artha, how you can become economically satisfied and peaceful and live a very prosperous life. You talked about karma, how you could satisfy all your desires. And you talked about liberation, how you can then finally leave this world. But you didn't delineate properly the process of bhakti. And without bhakti, you have deliberately avoided glorifying the Lord. So he said that words that do not describe the glories of the Lord are like places where crows go. So does anyone see, sometimes do crows come to the back of the temple where the garbage is?
White crows, yes.
White crows. I remember one time I was in Bombay, at the temple in Bombay. This is many years ago now, it has been renovated. But in the afternoon there was a big pile of debris and coconut things and cooking waste and so forth. And so many crows would come. And from inside the room you could hear them caw, 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 caw all the time, because they'd be coming flying and swooping down from the coconut palms and eating away there, and they made a lot of noise. So this is a place where crows go, where it's a little dirty and you put all your garbage. Crows like to go there. But swans don't go there. Where do swans go?
Lakes.
Lakes. and where they usually find the lakes. In parks and gardens, and beautiful places where there are flowers and trees and clear water, then swans would like to go there, and the crows won't go there, and the swans will go there, and the swans won't go to the garbage. They're just not interested in that. They're birds of a different feather. So crows and swans are quite different. They have different mentalities, and therefore they require different literature. So we see the crow-like people. You can see in any bookshop all the different things that are suitable for crow-like people. The sensational things, as Srila Prabhupada was talking, the mystery magazines, the this, the that, so on and so forth. But a swan-like person doesn't want these things. The swan-like person wants to hear something transcendental and something very sweet. So here, Narada Muni, he told Vyas, your problem is this. You haven't delineated enough about Krishna's pastimes. You must tell people about Krishna. They must hear about Krishna. Now this particular class, the subject matter, the title that I gave for this class was The Solution of All Problems. So as I was reading, I was trying to think, oh, now I have to tell everybody how to solve all their problems. And they may have all kinds of difficult problems that cannot be easily solved. But here, Narada is going to give the essence of the solution. So he said, he also chastised Vyas. He said, people want material enjoyment. Everyone does. We see this. And you have encouraged them in the name of religion. And therefore, now they will accept that as religion and hardly accept any prohibitions. So when Srila Prabhupada first came to the West, even his godbrothers were not as strict as he. And just imagine this, they were preaching to Indians who were cultured. But still they did not insist on the four regulative principles that Srila Prabhupada did. They didn't. They were very careful because they understood, okay, brahmachari, yes, sannyasi, yes, must be absolutely fixed. But grihastha, oh, they're entangled. So therefore, you tell them chant, you give them some philosophy, and they can do something. They weren't given the same type of respect that Srila Prabhupada wanted to be given to his grihastha couples. He wanted his grihasthas to be as serious, as capable in preaching, as were the brahmacharis and the sannyasis. So he gave these regulative principles, which were very, very, very difficult Westerners to follow, and factually speaking, many Westerners were unable to follow them, and still Srila Prabhupada stuck to the prohibitions. He was liberal, but why did he stick to these? They're so hard to follow. Why did he do this? Because he knew that you have to make a cut with the objects of attraction of this world, and simultaneously you have to hear about Krishna. One without the other, it won't work. If you try to hear about Krishna and enjoy the material world, you'll have one result. If you try to cut off from the material world but you don't hear about Krishna, you will have another result. But the process that Narada is giving is hear about Krishna. Hear Krishna's pastimes. Otherwise, the mind has no resting place. So I think we all sometimes experience this. So Vyas, he told him, you have given them sense enjoyment in the name of religion, and this is not very reasonable. But now, he said, because you have had a compromising spirit, this was his, of course only Narada can speak like this to Vyasadeva, we cannot speak like this about Vyas, because he is so exalted personality, but Guru is meant to find the fault. Because if Guru cannot be able to find the fault, who will find the fault? And many faults have kept us here in this lifetime for a very long, in this world for a very long time. So he said, now you should draw everybody's attention, and everything you should write should be only glorifying Krishna. He said, you should start to write these in this manner. And he said that even if somebody hears the pastimes of Krishna, becomes attracted to Krishna, and later due to their weakness or their association or some problem or another, they fall away from devotional service. They will never be able to get the taste fully out of their consciousness, completely removed from them, because if they've tasted the sweetness of Krishna's lotus feet, it will never fully go away. And practically there are so many examples we've seen of devotees like this. They may be unable to come up and up and up to higher and higher standards, but they can't completely leave Krishna because they've had a taste. So this is why we want to hear about what Krishna is doing at this time of the day. We're out playing. Just imagine if we were all playing in Goloka Vrindavan. Imagine if we were playing games and Krishna was at bat and you were bowling to him. I had one friend, one young man, and he was very attached to cricket. And I was saying to him at different times, you know, Krishna is more attractive than cricket. And he would look at me with a very strained look on his face, like he was just barely tolerating my blasphemy. And so one day I thought, I must try a different approach here. So I said to him, now just imagine, you're playing cricket here, and you're watching cricket on TV, and you're so absorbed in cricket. Which would be better, if you could play cricket here, or if you could play cricket in the spiritual world? Just imagine. And Krishna was playing with you, and you could defeat him. And all the same excitement and thrill and all the things you like about cricket, you could do that, but you could do it with Krishna, for Krishna's pleasure. Which one would be better? And I finally got him to say that that would be better. So for those who, we're all like that, we have something in this world that we like, and that keeps us from being able to say, I'm ready to leave this world, my family, my this, my that, so on and so forth. But Narada was telling Vyas, all those things should be engaged in Krishna's service. So there is one verse here, I'll just find. Prabhupada says, when advancement of knowledge is applied in the service of the Lord, the whole process becomes absolute. In other words, whatever is applied in the service of Krishna, whatever we use for Krishna's service, it takes on a different quality. It takes on a transcendental quality, sat-chit ananda quality. Otherwise, it takes on a asat, achit, an anananda quality, a temporary quality. So he says, the personality of Godhead and his transcendental name, fame, glory and etc. are all non-different from him. Therefore all the sages and devotees have recommended that the subject matter of art, science, philosophy, physics, chemistry, psychology and all other branches of knowledge should be wholly and solely applied in the service of the Lord. Art, literature, poetry, painting, etc. may be used in glorifying the Lord. The fiction writers, poets, and celebrated literatures are generally engaged in writing of sensuous subjects. But if they turn towards the service of the Lord, they can describe the transcendental pastimes. So this is actually what we have to learn to do. This is our transformation. That we should take part in to the best of our ability in this life, and if we cannot go any further than a certain point, no harm. Srila Prabhupada was very positive that even if one falls away, one shows only a certain 1% they do in devotional life, next birth they will start at the point of 2% and they will continue from there. So he was always positive, whether somebody came, whether somebody left, Srila Prabhupada would see both of these situations positively because something has been placed in their bank account. And that something, whatever it is, however much it is, that's theirs for eternity. It's not like the money that you put in your bank account from work that's there for a very short time. But this asset that you've acquired is there permanently. So Narada spoke in this way and he told Vyasadeva, use everything, engage everything, glorify Krishna and this will be to your great credit. Now while he was speaking like this, he changed the subject very slightly and he used himself as an example. He said he was speaking about himself. And he said that one time with his mother, because he was a little boy, with a mother who was in the very lower caste, she was a maid servant in an ashram. And so one time some sages came there for the summer, for the rainy autumn season and the rainy season. And they stayed for 4 months in that ashram. And during that time, his mother did all the menial service, cleaning their rooms, arranging things for them in different ways. And Narada would be there also. And he said that he was a very gentle boy. He didn't like to play a lot, running around and playing as most boys do. And of course there's no harm in playing. But he was a little exceptional. He was very well behaved, gentle. He liked to serve. He didn't talk a lot. Little boys like to talk and talk about so many things, but he would like to sit very quietly. And these sages took a liking to him. They thought, what a nice young boy he is. And so they gave him little things to do, and he did little things for them. And he became very fond of them. And they would speak to each other and discuss transcendental subject matter. And he would listen very carefully because he was attracted to them. So he would listen to their speech. He would observe their behavior. And then one time, because he was very shy, he wasn't a very bold child, he asked them if he could take the remnants of their prasad. After they had taken, he wanted to honor the remnants of their food, because as we know, this is one of the most potent ways to get someone's disease, right? If somebody has jaundice and you take the remnants of their food and eat it, good chance that you'll get jaundice as well. So just as it is very contagious, diseases are conveyed through the food that is touched to the mouth. In the same way also, transcendental infection is also possible. So Narada knew this. So he asked, can I take this? And they said, yes, you can have. So he took the remnants of the food and he became completely transformed by that. Because he was so faithful already, he was acting in such a gentle manner, then all of these sages' qualities gradually came into his heart. He said that by hearing, the flow of devotion began and the influence of the modes of material nature vanished. He became very attached to these sages and had very strong faith. And when they left, they instructed him in most confidential subjects. Sometimes the acharyas say that these sages actually taught Narada the nutshell verses of the Bhagavatam, the verses that were spoken by Krishna to Lord Brahma. The sages taught these to Narada, very confidential, very highly esoteric and internal transcendental knowledge was given to him. So then, he describes again, Narada goes on speaking to Vyasa and he goes right back in his preaching to the same point. He says that the best way to remove miseries, to remove our difficulties, is to dedicate one's activities to the service of the Lord. This is the best thing, because remember, Narada is going to become the person who will teach us how to engage in non-fruitive work. Now that's such a difficult thing to do. At times I have thought about it. Mostly I don't think about it. I'm just busy engaging in very fruitive work. But sometimes I have heard something and it has made me sit and think, I should think about this. How to engage in non-fruitive work. That means I have to be doing it solely for someone else's pleasure. And generally, even if I'm thinking I'm doing this for my children, I'm thinking I'm doing this for my children. And as soon as the I or the my becomes very prominent, I'm engaged in fruitive work. So how to do something that is exclusively not for my pleasure? It's not possible. There's only one way that one can actually do that, and that is if one has love and one wants to do something only that pleases another person. But in this world, there is no such pure love. Everyone in this world, because they have a conditioned tendency to be self-centered, when they love someone, it turns around again to be for their pleasure. So one may say, if I love Krishna, that's also for my pleasure. And the answer to that is yes, but that's natural. Because Krishna is the person that we should all love. Just as Krishna is the person we should play cricket with, Krishna is the person that we should all love. And I might say, but then I love my children. Should I not love my children? And the answer is, yes, you should love your children, but you should love your children as part of Krishna. You should gradually learn to see that they're Krishna's. You should see that Krishna loves your children, and that's why you love your children, not because they're mine. They're mine, and therefore I'm very fond of them, and I want them to do well in school, and I don't particularly care about anyone else's children, because they're not mine. We have to learn to give this up, and this is not something that's very easy to do. It will come about only as we develop a sense of love for Krishna. So then, again, he was speaking about this dedication of our activities in the service of the Lord. Then Vyas asked Narada a question. He said, how is it that, what did you do when the sages left? What took place after they left? So then Narada answered and he said, when the sages left that place, I went about my activities as before. And I was under the care of my mother, just a little boy. How old are you?
Eight.
So you are very big. He was only five. So five is very little. So when he was 5 years old, his mother loved him so much. He had no father, nobody else to take care of him. No one to take care of his mother but him. So therefore, mother and son, he was bound by her, the ropes of her love. And she was taking care of him very, very nicely. And one day, his mother went out to milk the cow. And while she was milking the cow, she became bitten by a snake. And when she was bitten by a snake, she died. Now, there's this little tiny young boy, so innocent, so sweet, so alone in the world. No one will take care of him now. What will he do? If this was an Indian movie or a Western movie, the music would become, oh, and everyone's tears would be running down their cheeks. Oh, the poor little boy, what's going to happen to him now? But Narada saw this in a different way because he had some transcendental vision. He saw that Krishna was dragging him to him. Let's hear what he says. I took this as the special mercy of the Lord, who always desires benedictions for his devotees. And so thinking, I started for the north. He walked out of that place to wander and wander and wander. And Srila Prabhupada says, confidential devotees of the Lord see in every step a benedictory direction of the Lord. Wouldn't it be nice to have that vision? How enlivened and stimulating our life would be. In every step, we see something of Krishna's dealings with us, something of Krishna's love for us, something of Krishna's plan for us, something that helps us to draw closer to Krishna in every step. So Prabhupada says, what is considered to be an odd or difficult moment in the mundane sense is accepted as special mercy of the Lord. Mundane prosperity is a kind of material fever, and by the grace of the Lord, the temperature of this material fever is gradually diminished, and spiritual health is obtained step by step. Mundane people misunderstand it. So even we may sometimes misunderstand, the mundane side of our nature may misunderstand Krishna's mercy. When he does something to drag us closer to him, we may feel that this is terrible, this is such a cruel act. But somehow or other, if he wants us to come to him, sometimes if he's very fond of somebody, he just goes like this and takes them. So he went in many different places here and there, and all the time he remembered the instructions of the sages, and he would chant and do his meditation, his process that they had given him. And one day he came to a very nice place, a very serene little forest with a nice running stream and a big banyan tree which was producing so much shade and coolness. So he sat down under that tree. And under that tree he began to meditate on the super soul situated within. Using my intelligence as I had been taught by these liberated souls. And as soon as he began to meditate on the lotus feet of the Lord, with his mind transformed in transcendental love, tears rolled down his eyes, and the Lord appeared in the lotus of his heart. Then, when he opened his eyes, actually he kept his eyes closed, and he meditated on the Lord in this way, and became absorbed in an ocean of mercy. And then the transcendental form of the Lord satisfies the mind and at once erases all mental incongruities became lost to him. He could not see him anymore. He was seeing him and he could not see him anymore. And he got up, he stood up and looked all around because now he was perturbed. What was that? He had this wonderful moment of experience and he could not see him anymore. And he was very desperate because this was what he was doing. This was how what his life was directed towards. He had achieved this and suddenly it had disappeared. So he became very disturbed and he looked around to see if he could find out what had happened. And then he sat down again and he thought, I would practice that again. I would do that again. What was I doing now? I was sitting like this and I had my eyes closed and I would concentrate. So he concentrated his mind and he sat and he thought, but he couldn't recapture that moment. And because he couldn't see him anymore, he started to cry. And he cried and cried and cried, just like a young boy all alone in the forest, crying and crying and crying. And Krishna spoke to him very pleasing words to take away the grief that he was feeling. Now Krishna appeared to him in this form. He appeared to him in the form of sound, Sabda Brahma. So he said to him, I regret that during this life you will not be able to see me again. So how would you feel? Oh, my whole life I'll never see you again. And he said, those who are incomplete in service and who are not completely free of all material taints can hardly see me. In other words, anyone who is not pure cannot see me like this, like you just saw me. You have seen me once in my person, and this is just to increase your desire to see me again. Because the more you hanker for me, the more you will become free of material desires. This is why we have to hear about Krishna. When we hear about Krishna and start thinking, I wish I could become Krishna conscious. I'm so un-Krishna conscious. I never remember Krishna. I have such a hard time doing anything devotional. I wish. I'm so unfortunate. This is not neurotic. It can become neurotic, but in its essence it is not a neurotic meditation. This hankering and this lamentation is what will remove from the heart all the ambitions and desires that are against the process of Krishna bhakti. This is such a science. Krishna consciousness, hearing about Krishna, is so spiritually scientific. So then he told him, by the service of the Absolute Truth, even for a few days, a devotee can attain firm intelligence in me. Consequently, he goes on to become my associate in the spiritual world after giving up the present deplorable material worlds. So he told Narada to reassure him. He told him, intelligence engaged in my devotion cannot be thwarted at any time. Even at the time of creation, your remembrance will continue by my mercy. So he gave him a benediction. You will always be able to remember me, but you can't see me again. You can always remember, but you cannot see me again. Not in this life. And then Narada tells Vyasa, he said, then that supreme authority, personified by sound, and unseen by eyes, but most wonderful, stopped speaking. Feeling a sense of gratitude, I offered my obeisances unto him and bowed my head. So Narada felt grateful. He had been given two things. He had been given the process and he had been given the benediction that you won't forget me. Don't worry, you won't forget me. But you're not yet ready to be with me. You continue in this way throughout your life, and at the end of your life, then you will come and be with me. So, understanding this and feeling very peaceful at heart, he began traveling everywhere and telling everybody the glories of the Lord and chanting personally himself. And then when it came time for him to leave this world, and when it came time for the next millennium, he was awarded by the Lord a body that was befitting to the Lord's association. Now Narada has an interesting position. This is Narada's position. All the other sages born from Lord Brahma, born from his mind, born from his body, from his meditation, they cannot travel freely in the spiritual world. They can travel freely in the material world, here, there, like yogis can travel, but they can't travel into the spiritual world because they're not completely free of every subtle contamination of anything to do with this world. But Narada, he can travel anywhere. He can go in the spiritual world, he can go in the material world, he goes here, there, here, everywhere. And just as he was walking as a young boy, grew up, glorifying, chanting, walking here and there, in his next life, he could travel by the airways. He could travel from planet to planet, place to place, dimension to different dimensions, and enter the spiritual world as well. And Narada goes here and there, and he has such a nice time. He has such a nice time. He's very playful sometimes also. One of his names is Kalaha Priya. And why has he got this name? Because he's very playful. He enjoys argument. Sometimes he sets people against each other. I will tell you a story. Remind me at the end. So then, again Narada glorified Krishna and told Vyas, "You are free from all sins. Thus I have explained my birth and activities for self-realization. All this will be conducive for your personal satisfaction also." And then he told him, "Please write the Srimad Bhagavatam. Compile this literature which glorifies the Supreme Personality and the Supreme Process of self-realization, so that the people in Kali Yuga can have this access. Just like if the lights all went out and this room was dark and I had a flashlight and I took my flashlight and held it up like this and everyone could see whatever was in the beam of the flashlight." So you might have seen the picture of Vyas holding up the Bhagavatam like this, and the flashlight, the light of the Bhagavatam, illuminates through the darkness of Kali Yuga, and you can see what is sinful and what is not sinful. And no other way can you recognize, because it is so subtle. The modes of material nature are so strong that most people do not know when they're committing sinful activities. But the Bhagavatam's light can illuminate a way, a path for you to leave aside the sinful activities and move on a path towards our loving relationship with the Supreme. So I will just read the last two verses purports where Srila Prabhupada is speaking about Narada Muni. He's talking first of all about Narada's freedom. He plays his veena and he wanders at his will. He can do whatever he wants whenever he wants. Now would you like to be able to do that? Yes. Would you like to be able to do that? Yes. Anyone here who wouldn't like to be able to be free to do whatever they wanted at their will? That's good. Get that very healthy. Because this is actually the nature of the soul. The nature of the soul is free. And so the desire to be free is not coming from the body. It will be colored by our nature in this world, our conditioned personality. But it's coming, it's the life of the soul to be free. Prabhupada says, "Every living being is anxious for full freedom." Yes? Because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through the transcendental service of the Lord. Illusioned by the external energy, everyone thinks that he is free, but actually he is bound up by the laws of nature. So I may think, I want to come to Melbourne. I'm getting a bit bored in Perth, I want to come to Melbourne. But then I have to go and buy a ticket, and I have to see if there are any available. And then I have to go to the airport. Then I have to get on the plane with all of these different people all congested. I have to do so many things. Get off at the other end, get into a car, drive all the way here. I have to do it in a particular way. I'm not free. I can't just think, I want to be in Melbourne, and there, I'm in Melbourne. Krishna can do that, and Krishna's associates can do that. They're completely free. And this is the freedom that we are being offered or is being returned to us if we can understand its value. A conditioned soul cannot move freely because, what to speak of, he cannot move freely from one place to another, even on the earth. What to speak of one planet or another. But a fully fledged free soul like Narada, always engaged in chanting the Lord's glory, is free to move not only on earth, but also in any part of the universe and in any part of the spiritual sky as well. We can just imagine the extent and unlimitedness of his freedom, which is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. His freedom is the same as Krishna's freedom. He is small, Krishna is unlimited. But this is our freedom. When we hear about Narada, when we hear about great personalities, we should know that there's a relevance to us. And that is because what they have, we have. One time Srila Prabhupada said, if you could understand your own qualities, you would be horrified at the position that you're in right now. Instead of thinking very happily, I can expand and do this and then I'll be happy with this and so on and so forth, my life is just how I want it to be, you'd be thinking, this is so constricting. Life in this world is so constricting. So much of me isn't actually able to blossom and flourish. As long as I am identifying myself, the objects of self-realization are my mind and body. I'm missing out on so much about me that I can't even imagine. So, there is no reason or obligation for Narada's travels, and no one can stop him. Similarly, the transcendental process of devotional service is also free. So then Prabhupada tells us that Narada plays on his veena to glorify the transcendental activities of the Lord and to give relief to the miserable living entities of the universe. No one is happy here within the universe, and what is felt as happiness is Maya's illusion. The illusory energy of the Lord is so strong that even the hog who lives in a filthy stool thinks he's happy. So when Prabhupada says over and over again, no one's happy, no one's happy, we may think to ourselves, I see so many happy people. I see happy people in the street. I've met so many happy people. These people are happy. Why does Prabhupada always say, no one's happy, no one's happy? It seems like as if he sort of isn't very, what was the word, like kind of cosmopolitan. You know, he just has a sort of his own circle of knowledge and he doesn't really see the rest of the world. He doesn't understand everything. But he's speaking from the spiritual point of view. And so he's saying what you call happiness and this person and that person calls happiness is actually not really happiness. And is not lasting happiness as well. No one can be truly happy within this material world. Srila Narada Muni, in order to enlighten the miserable inhabitants, wanders everywhere. His mission is to get them to go back home, back to Godhead. And that is the mission of all genuine devotees of the Lord, following in the footsteps of that great sage. Now, I was going to tell you one story about Narada, because we heard about what it's like in Goloka Vrindavan and in Javat at this time. Now it's getting a little dark, so Krishna would already be home. and his mother would have given him a bath and some butter and some other sweetmeats to eat, and be preparing him for the evening when he will sit, and so many different entertainers will come, and they'll sing songs and do different dances and so many different things for his pleasure. And everything in the spiritual world, everything in Vrindavan is centered around Krishna's pleasure. But one day, there's a place in Nandagram where Krishna lives. It's his residence. It's called Lalita Kund. And there's a very mischievous pastime took place there. So one day, Srimati Radharani was talking to Krishna, and she was glorifying Narada Muni and saying what a wonderful saintly person he was. And Krishna said, "Don't trust Narada. Don't trust him. He's entirely untrustworthy. Be very careful of Narada." And Srimati Radharani was thinking, "What is this? Narada Muni, he's such a great personality." Krishna said, no, he causes trouble wherever he goes. Be very careful with Narada." So Srimati Radharani did not take these words to heart. And meanwhile, at the same time, at Lalita Kund, this is Lalita Devi's place in Nandagram. So Lalita Devi was sitting there, very, very beautifully. She was making, threading garlands. So she would string one flower after another very delicately on a garland. Then she would hold up the garland like this, and she would look at it, and then she would break it, put it down, and she'd start making another one. And then she'd make another garland, and she'd hold it up like this, and she would look at it, and she would break it, and throw it away, and make another garland. And while she was doing this, Narada Muni came there. And he was looking from behind the bushes at this. And he was, "This is rather unusual. She makes a garland, breaks a garland, makes a garland, breaks a garland. What is she doing?" So Narada came, and he said, "What are you doing?" And Lalita Devi said, "Well, you see, I'm making a garland for Krishna. But then I look at it and I think, is that the right size? No, that looks a little small. Then I break it and I throw it away. And then I make another one. And then I look at it and I think, no, that's probably too small, to throw it away." So Narada Muni said, "Well," he said, that's not very intelligent. He said, "All you need to do is, you invite Krishna to come here and you can measure him. You see, you can measure the garland, and then you can understand what's the right size to make the garland, and everything is very simple." And so Lalita Devi says, "Oh, that's a very good idea." So Narada, he goes to Krishna, and he brings Krishna there. So Krishna comes, and Lalita Devi tries the garland. She gets the measurement right, and everything's all right. Then Narada, he says to Krishna, he says, "You know, do you remember you had given me one benediction? I could have one benediction from you." And Krishna says, "Yes." He says, "I have one thing I would like as my benediction." And Krishna says, "What would you like?" And Narada says, "I would like you to sit on the swing. There's a beautiful swing. There's still a jhulan at this place. There's a jhulan stand. So there's a jhulan. So he says, "I'd like you to sit on the swing." Krishna sits on the swing. And then he says, and you'll sit on the swing too?" And Lalita says, no. And he says, no. "I want you to sit on the swing too." So Lalita Devi, she sits on the swing. She's a little bit shy. And Krishna's sitting on the swing. And he says, "Now I want you to swing together." So then he says, so Krishna's swinging. So Narada says, "I'll be back in 1 minute. You keep swinging. I'll be back in 1 minute." swinging, nicely swinging. And he goes quickly to just nearby where Srimati Radharani is, and he's singing, "Jai Lalita Krishna, Lalita Krishna, Lalita Krishna." And Radharani hears this and says, "Lalita Krishna, what is this?" And Narada says, "Yes, you don't know, Lalita and Krishna, oh, they make such a good couple. Swinging together, having such a nice time." And Srimati Radharani goes, no. "Lalita, she'll be here any minute. She wouldn't do anything like this." And, no, "you come with me, I'll tell you." So he whispers a little something into Srimati Radharani's ear, and she goes very quickly to Lalita Kund. And when she gets there, she sees Lalita and Krishna swinging on the swing very nicely. And she becomes so angry and she turns around and she goes to leave and she's very angry. And immediately Krishna jumps off the swing and he says, "What is wrong?" And she said, "Oh, Narada told me that you were swinging on the swing together." And she begins to explain all the things that Narada has said. And then Krishna thinks all the things that Narada had said to him. But he asked me to sit on the swing. And he asked her to sit on the swing. And then Krishna said, "Now do you understand why you should never trust Narada?" So this is a wonderful pastime showing the playful side of Narada Muni's nature when he's in the realm of Braj. When he's in the material world, he's full of many philosophical instructions meant for persons like ourselves. But when he's in the spiritual world, especially in the Vrindavan area, then he's full of very playful, sweet pastimes. So we should hear the pastimes of Krishna. This is the remedy to get rid of this problem. And all our problems are coming from our attachments, which means our fruitive desires for things of this world. We should hear about Krishna, we should glorify Krishna, and we should learn the art of dedicating whatever we have in the service of Krishna. It's His, we're His. There is actually no duality. So we should try to take this process of hearing so that gradually, our heart will become cleansed. And as our heart becomes cleansed, we can understand Krishna properly. Now I'll read you one last quote before we finish our class, if I can find it. Yes. This is from Canto 3. This is Maitreya speaking, and he says, Nothing remains unachievable when the personality of Godhead is pleased with someone. By transcendental achievement, one understands everything else to be insignificant. One who engages in transcendental loving service is elevated to the highest perfectional stage. How? By the Lord Himself. Where is He who is seated in everyone's heart? This is a very important message for us. He is seated within your heart. He is seated within everyone's heart. And it is He who awards this when He sees that one wants it. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, the Lord gives intelligence to the pure devotees so they may be elevated to the highest perfectional stage. It is confirmed herein that a pure devotee who constantly engages in the loving service of the Lord is awarded all knowledge necessary to reach the Supreme Lord, to reach Him, to go where He resides. For such a devotee, there is nothing valuable to be achieved but the Lord's service. If one serves faithfully, there is no possibility of frustration, because the Lord Himself takes charge of the devotee's advancement. Imagine if we felt like that. He's taking charge of my advancement. The Lord is seated in everyone's heart, and He knows the devotee's motive and arranges everything achievable. In other words, the pseudo-devotee who is anxious to achieve material gains cannot attain the highest perfectional stage because the Lord is in knowledge of his motive. One merely has to become sincere in his purpose, and then the Lord is there to help him in every way. So here is our challenge. It's a big one. It's not a small one. To become sincere is not easy, but this is the challenge that is meant to be the challenge that we face in this life. This is what one stands to gain in a human life. So we will leave Narada here for this afternoon, and tomorrow we will hear some more words from Narada as he goes on his way. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
Actually, this is about the morning class.
Yes.
You know, you talked about the importance of simplicity.
Yes.
Could you kindly spend some more time or, elaborate on that? And you also said it can be cultivated, right?
Yes.
I want to know the how part of it.
Yes.
You know, if you can detail some.
It has something to do with becoming, being ready to become honest. The conditioned soul, that means ourselves, by nature we're dishonest. Because we're trying to get things in our own way. What we want to get it our way. So because Krishna is there, we can't see him because we've got our mind set. So if we hear about Krishna, if we associate with transcendental thought, transcendental concepts, Srila Prabhupada would use the word a lot, a misconception. He would use this as he would use rascal. People have misconceptions. That means they have a wrong understanding of something. So as my understanding, as I develop the right understanding by hearing from people who have the right understanding, who are above and outside of the conditioned atmosphere, as I listen to them and as I try to think about what they're saying as much as I can, to my own capacity, whatever it may be, then it's possible that I maybe start to become honest. And honesty may mean that I have to acknowledge that I have so many material desires in my heart. I'm not just a pure soul who just wants to leave this world and always reside in the spiritual atmosphere, but I have so many desires and ambitions and so many things are there. So what am I going to do with that? Now I'm starting to become simple, right? Before I didn't know I had them. I never defined them that way. I didn't think of them like that. I just thought that was life, and everyone does that, and that's what it's all about. But now I'm starting to see differently. Because I'm hearing. And so I'm starting to see that I have these things, I don't know what to do about them. That's the first step. To be able to see and evaluate oneself. When one first becomes a devotee of Krishna, whether one has been raised as a Hindu, which is like nominally devotional, or whether one has had no access at all to devotional life, when one first becomes a devotee, one starts to think how good one is. This is the first stage. You start to see, I'm actually very good, I'm doing very well, I'm actually quite nice. I'm actually nicer than that person, and I'm definitely nicer than that person. And one feels a sense of one's own self-importance. But as one proceeds on the devotional process, one begins to see that I'm not actually so nice. Now, when we see I'm not so nice, we could run away and hide that. That wouldn't be simple. That would be a simple thing to do, but it wouldn't make you simple. But we can admit that. Just like if I was caught in this room with so much money in my hand, somebody's wallet and something else, and they caught me and said, "What is this?" I can say I stole this. And it'll be humbling. I stole this and I can give it back. Or I can say, as many people will say, "I didn't steal it, it's mine. He has one just like mine, but this is mine. I brought it with me, I can tell you where I bought it, and I can make up a whole string of excuses why I'm actually not stealing. Don't say I'm stealing. I can go on and on and on, defense, this is called. But if one actually says, "Yes, it's true, I have so many problems," then one is making advancement. One is starting to come to a more advanced stage because he can see more accurately himself. And it doesn't feel as good. It was much more fun when I was so advanced. Now I feel like I'm getting less. But actually I'm becoming more to my size. Because I'm actually very small and Krishna's very big. Now, when I come first, I'm very big and Krishna's very small. So I'm very self-important. But now I'm starting to feel less self-important and Krishna's starting to become, oh, I never thought like that before. I have to think about this. And Krishna is starting to show prominence. And so as we admit our fallen condition, that I'm actually not very sincere, I'm not very strong, and if we can access a tiniest bit of desire somehow, and that's Krishna's mercy, that desire. That's not our sincerity showing. That's his kindness when he instills within the jiva's heart just a little desire. Wouldn't you like to come back to me? Wouldn't you like to develop your spiritual nature? Then when that comes a little bit, if we can say, "I'm very, very sorry. I'm like this. I'm full up to here with material desires. I have so many problems and this and that and that. But I would like to And one time one devotee told me, you might have to say, you can't say I would like to, because I wouldn't be honest, because if I like to, I would be doing it. Mm-hmm. So then he says, you go down another step. You say, I would like to. It doesn't quite feel right either, because if I really like to, I would be. I'm not. Okay, so I would like to. And he said, you find out where your prayer is honest. And when you find the point where it's honest, there you have strength. And there the simplicity begins. Even if you have to say, I'm light years away from wanting to do anything about this, but I've heard something and it's rung a bell somewhere, and I wish that I had some lifetime, millions of lifetimes from now, I had a desire to do something about this. It would be so nice. That's enough. Because Krishna is just waiting for us to become sincere. He's not like somebody who's saying, you prove to me, and then I'll come in and help you. He's like somebody who's saying, you know, he's like waiting to give us the mercy. But we're not eligible to take, we don't want it. That's why we can't have it. So first we have to become honest. And then we have to understand, what is my position? I may have just a little tiny something. That's all right. Because that can grow. That one little minute fraction of something sincere can be expanded upon, because that's my nature. And the example can be given as if you have a big brass bell, right? And it's so dirty, it's so encrusted, you don't know what metal it is, whether it's what it is. And if you can scratch it just a little bit and find out, oh, that's brass. Oh, okay. Then you've got the difficult process of cleaning it. But you know, I just clean it. And as I clean it, it's going to shine and it's going to be perfect. But I have to take up the process of cleaning it. So then we might need some help with that. Krishna's willing to help with that. He's willing to help with everything. So I know it's easy for me to sit here and speak. And it's much different when I'm sitting there listening and my mind is thinking, oh, that's a very difficult thing to do. And when sitting here you say, it's a very easy thing to do. But it isn't an easy thing, but it's a necessary thing. So therefore, this makes us simple. It's necessary. And it's very, very, very wonderful. So as we take it up, we get the strength to try to keep going through all the various levels of difficulty. The difficulty primarily is in the beginning. In the beginning stages, it's difficult to get our intense fire of bhakti started, lit and blazing. There's smoke and there's so many different problems. We've got to keep bringing fuel on and fanning it. But once it starts to blaze, then woof, all the fuel is burnt in a moment. So this is the process.
In Bhagavatam, we see that Krishna is glorified as equal to all the living beings. And simultaneously, he is also glorified as a Bhaktavatsa,
yes,
who always favors his devotees, and he, to any extent, he does that. So these both statements look contradictory. So how do you...
Well, it's not contradictory. It's like if you were describing my position and say that I'm lecturing to everybody in this room. Right? Everyone in this room, I'm lecturing to everybody. But I particularly like these two little children here. And so I'm particularly thinking of things to say that will attract them so they can hear. I'm doing the two things at the same time. I'm being fair to everyone, but I have a favor. I'm favoring these two. So Krishna's giving everybody, neutrally, everything. But when somebody just shows a little interest, he becomes very pleased. And he has a special partiality to that person. His partiality doesn't mean that he says, I'll give you something and nothing for you. And I'll give you all this. I'll give you all my impartiality. But to these people, I'll give my partiality. And Prabhupada said that's natural. And why do we love our children more than other people's children? Because it's natural. Krishna does it. Because Krishna's like that, we're like that.
But giving them some devotees particularly something more than others, is it not favoring? In that case, he doesn't become
partial. I'm favoring these two for a particular reason. I like them because they, whatever reason. And this, he does the same thing, I'm favoring three. And if that person down there, I recognize the same quality, I'm favoring them as well. I'm prepared to favor everybody. He's unlimited. So he has, Krishna has unlimited forms because he has a form that relates perfectly to every jiva. He's so intimate. He relates to this person this way, that person that way, this person this way. He's capable of that. We've never met anyone who's capable of that. We've never seen anything like that. So therefore we tend to think, no, I've never seen anything like that. How can I believe that? I don't see it. I can't believe it. But Krishna does do that. And this is what Shastra is telling us. So in the beginning we have only knowledge. But gradually we have realization as well. So Krishna can be intimate and he can be neutral to everyone who's neutral to him. They want that. And if somebody wants him, he says, oh, they're in the group that I especially favor. But anyone can join that group. It's not a sort of sect, you know, where it's these ones I favor and those I don't like. This is the difference. Yes.
Mataji, in the Leela of Narad Muni, Narad Muni has served a lot of transcendental personalities.
Yes.
And now when you said that they gave transcendental knowledge to Narad Muni, why did they restrict the knowledge of Paramatma realization to Narad Muni? They could have as well told him the Harinam chanting. Why did Narad Muni have to then receive that and then go through Paramatma realization, then the Lord going away from his vision and then again practicing bhakti and then realizing Paramatma?
It doesn't say that he had Paramatma realization. I don't know. Is that there?
It's my misunderstanding.
Yeah, no, it doesn't say that. He saw the Lord. Narada Muni is a devotee of Lord Narayan. So he has a Vaikuntha ras. So Narada, it doesn't say whether he saw Lord Narayan, whether he saw Paramatma. But he was meditating in a particular way and it was a personal exchange with him. But he had to wait some time because there were still some things in his heart that had to be cleared. So that example is for us. Right? Because if we, you know, we would think, oh, he just got so easily, I want so easily also. But we also have to wait some time. So when the living entity is praying to Paramatma or not praying at all, then Paramatma is prominent. Or when the living entity wishes to worship Krishna, then Krishna is prominent even from within. Because Paramatma Krishna is no different. But it's like a partial manifestation or a fuller manifestation according to the particular devotee's taste.
So the reason why I asked this question was Narad Muni went and sat under a banyan tree and started meditating.
Yes.
Now, which is the process of chanting, which we understand,
yes,
is much more potent than meditating within the heart. It's one level, it's the highest sadhana. So, why was Narad Muni not doing that right from the time that he left?
Oh, I see. That
was not.
This was the process he was given. And this is what the Bhaktivedantas gave him. They asked him to do this. I don't know what yuga that this is in, because the process of Harinam Sankirtan is most emphasized in Kali Yuga. So I don't know if this is a different yuga. I haven't studied that part, but I would think so. So this is what he was given and he faithfully followed it. So that would be my answer on that. Anything else? Yes.
We said that in case of the devotee, sometimes troublesome situation comes.
Yes.
That may be the arrangement of the Lord.
Yeah.
Hold it towards the Lord so that he can do more and more devotional service.
Yes.
But always when the troubles come, it may be the result of your past karma. So how to differentiate sometimes? Or whenever it's trouble in case of the devotee, it's only God's arrangement.
Sometimes it's both. Right, and so the mind of an advanced devotee We never know, right? We don't know, is this Krishna's mercy on me or is it right from my previous activities? But an advanced devotee amalgamates those two and sees that because of all the things I've done in the past, I deserve much worse than this. Krishna has minimized my past karmas. And he's only just given me a token. Just like if I should have had my leg cut off and instead I get a small cut on my foot, then I would be very grateful, right? And I would think, I deserve much worse than this. So this is how a devotee sees. They see Krishna's hand. They don't think like we would have to think because we're not so deeply devoted. So we will be thinking, is this this or is it this? How can I understand like that? So for us, we're taught to cultivate that mentality that I deserve whatever's coming to me. In fact, I deserve much more. And it takes a lot of strength of character to think like that when a serious difficulty arises. That's all right if you cut your finger, but if something very acute is happening, we're asked to train ourselves in the everyday ways of thinking like this so that when something acute happens, we can think like that. That I deserve much worse than this. And in that state of mind, in that mood, one sees Krishna's mercy in that step. So certainly there's a combination of the two in all circumstances. Krishna is arranging particularly for you. So he's using your circumstances and your destiny and your previous activities and molding, you could almost say, like some type of a medicine out of all of these and giving it to you so that by you taking that, it will be beneficial. So he's doing this in each person's case, but we cannot always see it. So we have to train ourselves to see in that way. That when something bad happens, I deserve worse. When something good happens, I don't really deserve this. This is Krishna's mercy only. And if we practice that in small things, we'll have the practice, we'll make the habit so that in bigger situations we'll have a chance of executing the same. Yes. Yes.
In the life of Narad Muni, when he came in touch with those Bhaktivedanta, the 5-year-old boy,
yes.
Is it the first time of Nitya Siddha Devotee? Is it the first time of Nitya Siddha Devotee, or was he eternally conditioned and then became perfect?
This is a little bit inconceivable, but it seems as though he's being used as both. We see, for example, another example in the case of Drona and Dara, that they were demigods, or they were in the higher planets, I'm not quite sure their situation. And they were praying, and they became the father and mother of Krishna. But the father and mother of Krishna are eternal. But Drona and Dara entered into that position, along with Nanda and Yasoda. So Narada is eternal, there's no doubt about that. But Srila Prabhupada, in many places, he will point to Narada Muni as somebody who became perfect by sadhana. So he's being used in both ways. In the highest sense, everything is a lila. Even our activities, in the highest sense, are a lila. But we are not the center of that lila. But we can never escape from being part of Krishna's plan. Everything is Krishna's plan. So you can say yes, but you don't want to say yes because you don't want to spoil the idea that he attained something. So if he attained it, I can attain it. So therefore, sometimes we will say yes, sometimes we will not emphasize that point.
And if we have this, one advance in devotion by accepting the remnants of pure devotees, how
does one advance in devotion by accepting the remnants of pure devotees? Well, I gave a good example that if you take somebody's food and they have a disease, it's contagious. And if somebody has AIDS, tuberculosis, some disease, cholera, and you eat their food, you can also get the disease. So because the transcendentalist has taken that food, they have offered that food, they're seeing that food as something that they are, it's Krishna's remnants, because of their perception of the transcendental nature. And added to that, their devotion, and the fact that perhaps they have even offered that to Krishna and brought it back, then when you take that, it does something to the heart. It spiritualizes the heart. It's imperceivable. It's not like you sort of just suddenly have like an electric shock and everything changes. But imperceivably, Prabhupada explains, imperceptibly one makes advancement by taking the remnants of prasad. It's one of the most important items of devotional service, actually.
So if some highly accredited devotee smiles at you or glances at you,
that's another way he shows his mercy.
Then the recipient of such a glance is spiritually advanced.
Yes, that's another way of giving mercy. I remember one time doing some interviews with people about Srila Prabhupada, because we were collecting, before everyone forgot everything, from different devotees, any memories they had of Srila Prabhupada. And so many devotees who had been initiated by Prabhupada, all they had in terms of exchange with him was a glance. He would come down the stairs on the one particular girl. She was a very well-known devotee at the time. She said, Prabhupada came down the stairs and he stopped and he looked at me and then he spoke to me. And I said, what did he say? You know, sort of interested to present something. She said, he said, chant Hare Krishna. But it completely changed her life. She was a world-famous model at the time. She gave it all up. She became a devotee living very simply because of the effect of the glance.
So is it the same thing when the spiritual master thinks about a disciple? The disciple is not personally present, and they're both situated in different locations.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's why we try to have a mood of serving. Because Krishna reciprocates with, as we heard this morning, he reciprocates with that devotee, and that's the way that he receives. One more. This one's been waiting a long time. Yes.
I just wondered about the remnants. The priest asked permission to take the remnants before he took it. Is that an important point? Because we sometimes take remnants of advanced devotees without their knowledge. So is it important in his transformation that he had his permission?
Srila Prabhupada seemed to not mind if devotees were very eager to take his remnants and even were a little bit kind of devious in their methods of achieving them. But it would seem that because he asked like that, he specially was focused on the significance and value of them, rather than maybe you sort of, you know, get all excited but you're actually not really understanding what you're doing. So clearly when you ask, that means, oh wow, this is a very significant moment for me. It stood out in his mind. But I don't think there's any injunction that you can't take without asking. Yeah. I think Keshav is giving me that look. But we can talk after, I think, because my husband will be back soon.
Two devotees to help during the group and just prepare some prasadam for the evening. So if anyone would like to, when we're finished, if you'd just like to go in and just help during the retreat, needs a little bit of help. And if anyone would like to give some fees, then please come and see me after we finish now.
Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki.